Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Christopher Kimball. Thanks for downloading this week's podcast. You can go to our website, 177milkstreet.com, to stream our television show, get our recipes, or take our free online cooking classes. Enjoy the show. This is Most Your Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball.
Being back here, and appropriately enough, in a town called Freedom, and kind of finding myself here in this space at this place called The Lost Kitchen, I look back and I was like, oh my God, all those tears I cried. You know, it's like my life was falling apart. It's like I was crying rivers, and it like somehow magically brought me to a waterfall.
That was Aaron French, the head chef and founder of The Lost Kitchen, a small restaurant located in Freedom, Maine. I sat down with French to discuss how she went from pop-up dinners to owning one of the most exclusive restaurants in America. But first, I interview Washington Post reporter Maura Judkis about the wild, wild world of pumpkin spice. Maura, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
You wrote a piece, you're at the Washington Post, you wrote a piece about spending a week buying every pumpkin spice product you could. So let's just talk about some of the strange products, either kefir, dog treats, mm-hmm. although you said your dog liked them.
My dogs like everything.
Paper towels, mm-hmm. gluten-free frozen waffles, spray. So what were the products you enjoyed most, if any, I should
say? I ended up liking the yogurts a lot, actually. They were kind of like just pretty simple, a nice way to start the morning, not too sweet. You know, the thing with a lot of these pumpkin spice products is they end up being like just very corn syrupy, very right. sweet, lots of baked goods that don't really have a lot of pumpkin flavor to them. They're just more sugar and nutmeg altogether.
And the worst on your list was scented candles, which I can't stand under any you know, scenario, but that must have been pretty bad, right?
Those were pretty bad. The absolute worst thing was a can of spray on pumpkin spice. You know, I've never seen anything like this before. It's like, it's organic, first of all, but it's in this can. It looks like a can of hairspray, and you can just drench anything in the flavor of pumpkin spice. You could put it on anything. You could put it on toast. You could put it in something horrible like wine if you wanted. And it really just tastes like you sprayed an air freshener directly into your mouth.
Well, I bet some people buy it. So obviously,
I'm certain
there is a market for everything. So let's just back up. So Starbucks sells $80 million in annual revenue in pumpkin spice products. Is that right?
Mm, it's by far their most popular seasonal drink.
And I don't get this. You referred to pumpkin spice as a lifestyle. So what, I know with tongue in cheek, but what mm-hmm. is it about pumpkin spice? Why pumpkin spice? I don't get it.
It's just sort of become this thing. Like it's like, I kind of call it the pumpkin spice industrial complex. You know, it just becomes bigger and bigger every year, more products. It starts earlier and earlier, and it's kind of brought up this whole class of merch, like pumpkin spice merch. People really love to proudly declare that they're very into pumpkin spice. You know, I saw these shirts that say, pumpkin spice is my favorite season, or I like pumpkin spice a latte, or leggings, boots, and pumpkin spice. And people are just really, really into declaring their love for this particular seasonal flavor.
So philosophically speaking, what is this telling you about American culture and where we're headed?
I think it is a comfort for people to have this favorite drink of theirs, and it makes it very special that you can only have it a certain time of year. It's only in stores for about 2 months. And I think that that's something that people look forward to. And while it's really not my favorite drink, quite frankly, having done this story, I really never want to have anything pumpkin spice ever again. I think that, you know, there is something to the fact that it's very, very comforting to people to have this particular blend of flavors, and it makes them feel very warm and nostalgic and maybe loved.
So pumpkin spice is about love. Okay, well,
it's also about making money, I think, too.
So this got started in 1936. There was a recipe actually in the Washington Post. Is that right?
Yeah, well, that ended up being a big surprise to us. So in researching for this story, I was very curious to see what the very first reference to pumpkin spice was. And I did a Nexus search, and the first thing that came up actually was a 1936 recipe that ran in the Washington Post. And it was a very strange recipe. It at one point referred to pumpkin as, quote, a food of the Italian peasantry. And it was a recipe that, you know, we ended up remaking the original recipe, and it called for so much shortening, a full teaspoon of mace, raisins. It wanted the recipe, or wanted the cake to start in a cold oven. And it ended up being this, like, incredibly dense loaf that had this very overwhelming taste of mace. But it was very curious to find out that, in a way, we at the Washington Post are the cause of some of this pumpkin spice madness.
So this became a blend of cinnamon, clove, nutmeg, and ginger. Is that really what the essence of this is now, today?
Yeah, cinnamon, clove, nutmeg, ginger, allspice. You know, I mean, different products have varying levels of each of those flavors.
And at Starbucks, this is just a flavored syrup they put into it. Is that how they do it?
It is, yeah. And actually, for a while, it didn't even contain pumpkin. And when people found out about that, they were upset. And so now I think it contains, like, a trace amount of pumpkin.
Well, I don't think most people like pumpkin, actually. I mean, isn't butternut squash what's in most cans of pumpkin for the holidays anyway? I mean, let's go back to your week. How was the week? You kept going every day to buy stuff for the supermarket. But what about non-edibles? What kind of non-edibles were there?
Well, the best thing I ended up trying, or I wouldn't say it's the best. It's kind of just the weirdest. I ended up buying a pumpkin spice scented deodorant, which was very strange. Yeah. And so it's from this company called Native, and it popped up. You know, I made a pledge to myself that I would buy any pumpkin spice thing that crossed my path, whether in a grocery store or online. And this, I think it showed up as an ad on Facebook or something. And so I bought it, and it arrived, and it definitely smelled kind of like vanilla or nutmeg. It was hard to really place the scent of it. But it is very strange to tell people that you're wearing pumpkin spice deodorant.
And did you find love? or did someone ask you, what's that funny smell?
Well, my husband thought it was vanilla, but I made him guess. I didn't tell him what it was. And I think it smelled a little bit more like nutmeg. But quite frankly, I think I'll just stick to regular deodorant from now on.
So the one question I will leave here is, what's next? I mean, this everything runs the gamut, right, at some point. Although pumpkin spice has held on for quite some time. How long has Starbucks been offering it, do you know?
Starbucks has been doing it since 2003, so it's going strong for 15 years. Although there's been some research recently that the pumpkin spice market is not growing as quickly as in previous years.
Oh, no. That's terrible.
Yeah, I know. So the dollar sales of pumpkin flavor items were actually at a peak in 2017, but the growth year over year has been much slower over the past few years. So it does appear that the pumpkin spice market is kind of slowing down. So I guess we'll see what happens this year. It seems like it happens earlier and earlier. Maybe people will ease off on the August pumpkin spice release of products. I'm not really sure.
Well, this is my prediction. Fruitcake. I mean, you don't want to eat fruitcake, but maybe that's a nice spice. Or mincemeat. That'll barely do it. A nice mincemeat latte. Maura, thank you so much. An update from the pumpkin spice wars. It's still going strong. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That was Maura Judkis, reporter at The Washington Post. Her article is called, I used every pumpkin spice product I could find for a week. Now my armpits smell like nutmeg. Mill Street Radio is also available as a podcast. You can subscribe, download our shows, and listen whenever you want. New shows are available every Friday on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Spotify. Right now, my co-host Sarah Moth and I will be taking your calls. Sarah is, of course, the star of Sarah's Weeknight Meals on public television, also author of Home Cooking 101. Sarah Moulton, how are you?
I'm good, and I'm ready to hear what people want to know.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Steve Golden from Chicago.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm good.
How can we help you?
I've been wondering if there's a rule of thumb for how to use water. With potatoes, you're supposed to put cold potatoes in cold water and bring them to a boil until they're soft. And with eggs, you put cold eggs in cold water until they're hard.
Yeah.
And in pasta, you boil the water and then put it in. And I've noticed that you've been talking a lot recently about water by itself as an ingredient.
That's an excellent question. You're a philosopher, sir. I like that. That's one of those things that keeps you up at night. I would say cold water for potatoes is so the potatoes don't fall apart.
So they cook evenly, because otherwise they'll get mushy. If you throw them into boiling water, the outside will get
overcooked.
Cooked before the inside is cooked.
And for eggs, it's just a really good way to time the cooking time. Pasta, obviously, there's no benefit in starting in cold water.
Because it would get mushy as heck by the time it came up to a boil.
You couldn't time it. I think a lot of it's about not overcooking the outside and timing the cooking would be why you would sometimes use either boiling water or cold water.
You also think about pasta and it's much thinner than either a potato or an egg. So that's why you want to just throw it into already boiling water because it's not going to be in there for very long anyway.
There is a trick to that, which is use less water than you think. And then the starch from the pasta gets into the water, and you can use that water to make the sauce cling to your pasta. So less water is good. Give us a couple more examples of anomalous uses of water.
You know, like with rice, you cook it till the water's gone away.
That's a good one, actually.
That sounds so poetic.
Yeah, that is very, that's a koan. And,
you know, and then there's your new way of cooking a chicken.
Yep, throw in the water.
Put it in water and you end up with a cooked chicken and stock. You know, with our potato and egg and pasta, we throw it away in a soup. The water becomes the meal.
I guess I would go back to the beginning of time when water really was the cooking medium.
It was the only thing.
And it's a great thing because it's a fairly low temperature and it's consistent. You know, the timing is going to be perfect. It's a fairly gentle way of cooking.
You know, I have a couple of water tips if you
love to hear them.
Let's hear them.
You always hear when you make pasta, keep a cup or so of the water.
Yep.
And what I like to do is strain the water into your serving bowl and then
heat the bowl.
You're ready to serve, dump out that.
Yeah, that's a good tip.
You know, you've got as much water as you want. And then when you put that out, your serving bowl is piping hot.
Yeah,
brilliant.
Excellent. I'll just leave you with one last thing. We just were in Italy doing a cacio e pepe, cheese and pepper pasta. And we came back here and we couldn't get it to work because the cheese always got gluey and, you know, was nasty. It turned out it wasn't the cheese. It was that in Italy, they cook a lot of pasta in water, so it's full of starch. So that starch kept the cheese from clumping together. So our solution was to use less water to cook the pasta and all adding a little cornstarch when we melted the cheese in water. So starch in water, when you cook something like pasta, is an essential ingredient to a lot of recipes, especially a cheese-based sauce.
Right.
In that case, the water was the binder with the starch that allowed the cheese not to bind together. So,
any rate, Steve, thank you for calling. That was a lot of fun.
I feel much better about
it. Great
I do too.
Talking to you guys.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Take care.
All right.
Bye.
Bye now.
This is Mill Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. If you have a burning culinary question or just want to debate the merits of bay leaves, give us a call anytime at 855-426-9843. One more time, 855-426-9843, or email us at questions@millstreetradio.com.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Chris.
Hi, Chris. Where are you calling from?
Columbus, Wisconsin.
Oh, nice. And how can we help you today?
So I just want to ask about, you know, different non-traditional meat sources like tongue and, you know, kidney. And how would I prepare, you know, if I wanted to make, you know, beef tongue sandwiches, and how do I do it?
Well, you simmer the tongue in liquid, you know, with aromatics if you want, you know, vegetables. You could add some pickling spices if you want, maybe a little bit of wine. Simmer it gently for hours. It depends on how large it is. It's roughly about 50 minutes, 50, 60 minutes a pound.
I would do it like Pottofe or Tafelspitz, which is the Austrian version of Pottofe, which is you cook it in a flavored water. You know,
or you could chicken broth.
Or broth.
Yeah, chicken broth, beef broth.
Very low simmer, mm-hmm. barely simmering, and cook it for probably a couple hours, something like that, till it's cooked. That's how I would do it.
50, 60 minutes a pound. And then you peel it, and you do that while it's still warm. It's easier. And then place where I worked, we throw it back into the cooled, somewhat cooled broth just to keep it moist. You know, keep it like that and then slice it as we needed it. Another really good one is rabbit. Rabbit's very lean, but, you know, you just don't overcook it or you gently stew it.
No, you have to do the same thing. The legs, first of all, the front legs don't have much meat, so it's the back legs you braise. And then you cook the tenderloin, the strap, for about 6 minutes at the end.
Quickly.
You can't cook both of them at the same time.
Right.
Yeah, we do a lot of pressure cooking of rabbit and then deboning and then putting the deboned meat into whatever we're going to make. The pressure cooker has been our best friend and ally for rabbit, squirrel, and duck. Yeah.
Really?
Wow, you are serious. Squirrel.
I've never thought about doing that. That's
yeah,
a good
that's
idea.
The old Brunswick stew, right? Wasn't that the original protein?
Yes.
Well, no, Brunswick stew was whatever you could catch.
Yeah.
My daughter calls it squirrel chicken because she likes it so much.
Well, I have to say I've never eaten squirrel.
I have.
Does it taste like chicken?
The red squirrel? Yeah, your red squirrel or gray squirrel? Red squirrel. Yeah, I mean, I guess. I mean, it's what...
It's not real gamey?
No, back in the 70s and 80s in Vermont, I had neighbors who did hunt everything, including that.
Hmm.
Woodchuck. Eat woodchuck stew. A little greasy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay, then.
Squirrel's like dark meat chicken with kind of a nutty flavor.
Oh, I'd like that.
I just
okay.
want to tell you
good.
What it is. That's all. Hmm. So you ask for seconds.
Yeah.
So there you go. I think pressure cooker is actually, of this conversation, the best idea that
came
out.
Yeah, that's exciting.
That's a good idea.
I'm going to check that out.
Yeah.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you guys very much. Enjoy your show.
Okay, thanks. So Sarah, next time I have a couple extra squirrel, I'm going to...
Just invite me over. I'll be there.
Stop by.
I'll try. You can try anything once.
It's fine. It's not a lot of meat on it, but it's better than guinea pig.
You've eaten guinea pig?
Greasy, bony.
Oh, dear.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Coming up next, my conversation with Aaron French, head chef and owner of The Lost Kitchen in Freedom, Maine. We'll be right back.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You know, I like classic clothing that never goes out of style, and that's why I suggest you check out Quince, an online clothing store that focuses on timeless essentials at great prices. I recently bought a Mongolian cashmere sweater for under $100. It's a great sweater and a great deal. Now that warm weather is upon us, Quince has all the seasonal must-haves, like 100% European linen shirts from $30, performance polos, and versatile flow-knit activewear. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands by partnering directly with top factories. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. Upgrade your wardrobe. Go to quince.com/milkstreet for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/milkstreet to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/milkstreet. You know, wonderful pistachios have become my go-to snack. Now, I could list all the health benefits. They're a good source of protein, fiber, and unsaturated fats. But for me, flavor comes first, and that's why it's pistachios, not peanuts, in our household. Wonderful pistachios come in a variety of flavors and sizes, including sea salt and vinegar, chili roasted, and smoked barbecue. Check out wonderfulpistachios.com to learn more. That's wonderfulpistachios.com. This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Today I chat with Erin French at her restaurant, The Lost Kitchen, in Freedom, Maine. Her small eatery, located in a renovated mill next to a waterfall, is off a small side street in a town that is easy to miss. To get a reservation, one has to send in a postcard in April, and names are chosen by lottery. Of the 20,000 requests, less than half get a seat at the table. I went to Freedom to ask Erin how she went from pop-up dinners cooked out of a 1965 Airstream to founding one of the most exclusive eateries in America. Erin, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
It's great to be here in Freedom, Maine, in the middle of nowhere, sort of. So you had a family diner.
Yes.
What was the name of the diner?
Ridgetop Restaurant. It's like named after a Jesse Colon Young song. My parents were hippies.
so your parents were hippies back in the 70s?
In yeah.
Maine? Really?
Yeah.
I was a hippie back in the 70s. I was in Vermont. I wasn't in Maine. So what about the food? Was this a lot of homegrown food? Do you have chickens, the whole thing?
Or? We had chickens. We had a garden. We had a lot of potatoes. It was kind of the big crop. Peas, peppers, cucumbers, all of those kind of things.
And lots of people coming over for communal dinners?
No, not really. Everyone was so busy. It's not like we weren't like an entertaining household because my dad was working at the restaurant 16 hours a day. My mom was a school teacher. So it was kind of just these rushed dinners by mom while dad wasn't home in the evening, which would usually be like running out to the garden and grabbing some spinach and poaching an egg and throwing some bacon into it. And it's like, okay, that's dinner tonight, whatever you can get in the garden.
But when you worked at the diner, your dad's diner, that was burgers, right? I mean, that was typical diner food, or was that a hippie diner?
Oh, yeah. No, it was typical diner, fried fish baskets, burgers, meatloaf, roast chicken, roast pork, all of those kinds of things.
So working in the diner actually motivated you to go into the restaurant business? It didn't cure you of being in the restaurant business?
No, that's kind of funny. Actually, working in the diner, when I started working there, I was probably 12 when I started cleaning up after my dad, and 14 when he finally let me start to work on the grill. And if anything, it just made me want to get away from food and want to get away from here and try to find something else. But it's funny, once I got away, I started to appreciate this place and wanted nothing but to just get home, and then kept finding food again and coming back to food and coming back to food because it was familiar and made me feel good.
So you wanted to come back. You did have a previous restaurant, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was in an old bank or in the basement of an old bank?
Yeah.
Where was that? What town was that?
I had a restaurant in Belfast, which is on the coast, 20 minutes from here, which kind of started, it actually started as a supper club because when I was turning 30, I had this mini 30 midlife crisis of like, what am I doing with my life? What am I contributing? And I had nothing to show but food. And so I said, okay, I'm going to make a go of food, and started this little supper club in my apartment because I had no money. And slowly it sort of mushroomed and people started to hear about it and show up. And then I got a little more confidence that maybe I could make a go at this, open a restaurant. So I had my first restaurant in Belfast in 2011.
So I do want to ask you, so you went away briefly, you came back.
Yeah.
The keys, the locks have been changed on the restaurant.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so you went from having your own restaurant to not having your own restaurant.
Yeah, to having like a suitcase full
about
of like...
about 30 seconds.
Yeah,
right?
Just like that. Right. Everything gone.
So you came back to Freedom. How old were your parents? What were they doing when you came back?
You know, my parents were, my mom had retired from teaching. My dad had sold the restaurant, and they were supposed to be just enjoying retirement. And then their grown daughter moves back in and then tried to figure out like, well, I can't just stop. What am I going to do? And I have this restaurant, but I don't have it anymore. But I have me, and I don't have any walls, and I don't have a space. And that's when I found this old Airstream that I gutted and turned into my living quarters and also a mobile kitchen that I started to travel around and sort of bring back the supper club that I had started years before that.
So let's just talk about Freedom. It's, what, 700 people?
719.
Yeah. So that's small. We drove through Freedom and we didn't realize we did. but it was, we went by the main convenience store. And this is 2.5 hours north of Portland or something like that.
Yeah, we're about an hour 45 north from Portland.
So you're 30 years old. You're in a very small town. What's that like?
When I came home for the second time, it was really because I had no choice. It threw me there because financially I didn't have a penny. I, you know, had lost my home. I'd lost my business. And so it was like, okay, this is just survival mode. And then, you know, when you start to look around and realize that, like, this is my home and this is a place that I love so much, and how can I nurture my life here and live a good life here and, you know, just figure out how to move forward. And, you know, for me, it's, if you had told me that this is what I'd be doing with my life, I would have said, there's no way. You can't make a living in Freedom. You're told that you have to get away. You have to go to the city. You have to, you know, get out of here to be successful and to survive. And, you know, that's not the case anymore.
So you're open half the year, roughly, or a little more?
Yes. We our normal schedule is beginning of May till New Year's Eve, and we're open 4 nights a week.
So people come to dinner from all over, but you don't serve wine in the dining room. So you have a wine cellar. So just give us a sense of what of actually going through the meal here at the Lost Kitchen.
Yeah, we have, strangely enough, in the town called Freedom, we have old prohibition laws that are still in place, so we are not allowed to pour wine, but we found a way around that, and it's worked out really great. We were able to turn some of our basement space into a wine cellar. So guests arrive around 5:30. They head to the wine cellar, where we have all of our lovely ladies there greeting them, and they'll share the menu for the night because no one knows what they're having. It's basically like going to your friend's house and not knowing what she's making for dinner until you get there. So we help pick out and pair wines and share the menu and then send everyone upstairs to the dining room for dinner at 6 o'clock. And then we just have about 3.5 hours of food that just starts coming out. Everyone just sits back and relaxes and pours their own wine, and they don't have to think about anything. And that's what I love about this experience. The only decision they have to make is if they want coffee or tea, and that's it.
Oh, I like that. I don't like big menus.
I get overwhelmed.
Yeah.
You know, you go out and she's like, I just want to relax and I have to sit here and stress over this menu and it's got 2 sides or 4 pages and I just want to talk with my friends and enjoy and just have beautiful food come out.
So let's talk about food. I mean, the food world has exploded, imploded in the last 10 or 15 years. There's every possible style. There's a mix from all over the world. Your cookbook, I would say, has simplicity of concept probably is the thing that really stands out, and a certain grace to the food. If you were to describe, which is probably a stupid question, but if you were to describe your cooking, what is your cooking?
Yeah, that's one I've struggled for because, you know, I feel like it's a blend. It's representative of me, but I'd say that the best, if I could give you a term, I'd just say it's kind of a modern version of farmhouse cooking.
And farmhouse, there's lots of different kinds of farmhouses. There are farmhouses in Alabama. There are farmhouses in Vermont. Is this New England?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. You know, all of the ingredients that inspire me are the ingredients that I open my eyes to every day. So, you know, whether it's seafoods that are right from here, any of the produce, all of my cooking is 100% driven by ingredients. I never make a menu and then go searching for ingredients. I let the ingredients come, and then it's my job to figure out how to combine them and how to put them together.
Let's talk about some basics. So you have a bread salad, for example, in the book. Just talk about using bread or leftover bread, because in a lot of places in the world, you know, they make soups out of bread, obviously, like Lablabi. They make croutons out of bread with some olive oil and salt in a skillet. If you're talking to someone who's a home cook, how do you think about using bread in a different way?
You know, for me, I'm pretty simple with it. So I'm always first using the first slice to just slather with butter and good salt and eat it that way. And then taking the scraps. And again, just I love doing skillet croutons, whether serving it with salads or chickens or making bread puddings. Those would be, you know, I'm pretty old fashioned. This is like grandmother food. That's like my version of it.
Chicken. So I'm sure you have a local supplier for chicken. But if you go into the supermarket and you can find Bell and Evans or something, you know, it's okay. But do you have some tricks for grilling chicken or roasting chicken? Is it to salt it and let it stand for a while, brining, or you just have to start with a great chicken?
Well, great chicken is obviously key. If you can find someone who's actually, you know, a local person doing it, the difference is just unreal compared to supermarket chicken. But if you can't, yeah, go with organic or just the best all natural you can get. But brining is amazing. It's easy, and you just steep it overnight, and the flavor will just wow everyone. And yeah, roasting, lots of salt. Salt and butter are my big keys for roasting and salting the cavity and just keeping the skin really dry.
You said this is Applewood grilled spring chicken already. It says in a large pot over medium heat, this is after you've brined the bird overnight. Bring the chicken and brine to a slow boil. Reduce the heat and simmer until just cook through. So you brine overnight, and instead of just taking the birds out of the brine, you heat the brine?
Explain that
to me.
Okay, so this is a little hostess trick, because the worst thing you want to do is have your friends come over and you're grilling and it's already challenging, it's open flames, you know, you're fighting that. You don't want to worry if the chicken's cooked through, so you actually pre-cook, par-cook that chicken a little bit in the brine so you have the flavor, and then all you have to worry about doing is just browning it and, you know, getting it looking good on the grill.
I didn't think you'd ever use the term hostess trick. You don't look like the kind of person who would say hostess.
That
sounds very 50s.
I always feel like I'm a hostess. Like, I don't feel like a chef. I feel like I'm a hostess. That's what I am. That's what I really feel like. Like, this is what I was born to do. It's just like, have people over for dinner. Just want to be a hostess. It feels really, I do the flower arrangements, you know, pressing the napkins. That's my joy.
Spoon cakes, rhubarb spoon cake. You have cakes made in skillets. You also have a sort of tart tatin or upside down cake with pears. So If someone wanted to, people always ask me, you know, how do I cook without a recipe? And I say, don't. But in baking, it's particularly hard. But a upside down cake or a cast iron cake, fruit cake, skillet cake, are there some just a basic recipe for that? I mean, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, for me, follow a recipe. Don't mess with it unless you are really trying to develop something, which if you're at home, you're probably not trying to do that. You just want something that's going to work, and you don't want to waste your ingredients. So for me, coming up with a couple of staple cake recipes, but then playing with it and working with whatever you have for fruit, so you don't have to be like, oh, well, I don't have pears. Well, that's okay. Use peaches or apples. And so it's kind of a free-form cake, but if you have that basic batter recipe, have a few good ones. Have something cornmeal-y, have something vanilla-like. You know, have a few of those tricks up your sleeve, and then make it your own as far as fruit. Go from there.
So you would cook the fruit, caramelize it in the bottom of the pan with some sugar and butter, then add the batter. I think one of your batters was half cornmeal and half all-purpose,
which
sounded very good.
Yeah, it's nice because that sort of keeps it fluffy, so it's not like this over bitey cake. You want to have a little bit of fluff to it, so that all-purpose helps cut that a bit.
You have a pork burger recipe, of course. Everyone's got to have a burger recipe. And you put something on it that's a little different.
Yeah, peaches. Peaches are surprising. And then more bacon. So it's like pork, which always makes things better. And blue cheese. I love pork and peaches. And it's just summery, and it's a little different. And I think it's a really nice combo.
Was there a moment in this process, there probably was a lot, where either things looked really bleak, or the first time you thought you were going to make it, that just sort of sums up this experience for you?
Wow. That's a hard one. I mean, there's plenty of moments when I thought I wasn't going to make it. Yeah, probably after I lost that first restaurant, I was just like, I was spinning. I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know if I was going to live. There were some very, very dark days, and part of coming home was the salve for that, and food also got me through that. So just kind of discovering myself through food and being back home and being around my friends and my family and just moving forward together.
So I'm 67, still haven't found myself. You're half my age or something like that, 37, and you have. And you've done it fairly quickly, and you come out of a very difficult experience. Did you always know who you were and were very centered? Or is the process of building this Lost Kitchen here in the mill, was that what got you there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I feel like I've just figured out who I am. 30 was kind of the mark of where I knew that I hadn't, and it was terrifying. But, you know, I really needed to hit a really hard wall and have my life fall apart, I think, in order to find myself. It basically started me at ground zero. So being back here, and appropriately enough, in a town called Freedom, and kind of finding myself here in this space at this place called The Lost Kitchen. And I look back and I was like, oh my God, all those tears I cried. You know, it's like my life was falling apart. And it's like I was crying rivers, and it like somehow magically brought me to a waterfall.
That was Erin French, head chef and owner of The Lost Kitchen. Her cookbook is called The Lost Kitchen, Recipes and a Good Life Found in Freedom, Maine. You know, my wife and I did have dinner at The Lost Kitchen. Erin prepares the food at a stove in the dining room, handling five or six courses, plating food, and on that particular evening, she cooked 45 lamb chops in two batches in cast iron skillets. And she didn't break a sweat. Yes, the ingredients were local. Yes, the food was beautifully plated. Yes, the combinations of flavors and textures were first rate. But it's intent, the spirit in which the food is harvested, prepared, cooked, and served, that makes The Lost Kitchen special. You know, good food is an invitation to share a life, not just dinner. And Erin French has a great life to share. Right now, I'm heading into the kitchen in Milk Street to chat with Lynn Clark about this week's recipe, Spanish almond cake. Lynn, how are you?
I'm great, Chris.
So we're talking about flourless cakes today, but this is an almond cake, not chocolate, which, of course, is that 1980s standby in every restaurant.
Yeah.
And this comes from Spain. So is this a traditional recipe in Spain?
It's a traditional recipe in a region of Spain called Galicia. We went to a bakery there called Casa Mora. It's called the Tarta de Santiago. It's a flourless almond cake, really simple one-bowl cake. If I were to describe it, I would say it's almost like if you took a French macaron and made it into a cake. It has kind of chewy but dense texture, but somehow the density is not leaden. It's kind of a light dense, if that makes sense.
Well, macaroons are light dense.
Exactly.
And I'm kind of light dense, too. So this is the perfect cake for me. So you said it's a one-bowl cake. So how do you make it?
So traditionally made with whole eggs. We found we couldn't get the lightness we wanted from whole eggs. We tried separating the eggs, so whisking egg yolks with sugar and then whipping egg whites separately. It was really hard to incorporate the whites into this base. This base is really, really thick, almost like Play-Doh with the almond flour in it. So we couldn't really get the whites to really give us the lightness we were looking for. So we tried something interesting by using whole eggs and then just adding extra egg whites. So that allowed us to incorporate that air we wanted, but kept it really simple, all in one bowl.
Is this baked in a cake pan or a springform pan, or how do you bake it?
So first we mix those eggs together with sugar, almond extract, vanilla extract, salt, and then you whisk that really vigorously for about 45 seconds, and then add the almond flour. It goes into a cake pan, just a 9-inch prepared cake pan, and we top it with a combination of chopped almonds and turbinado sugar. That mm-hmm. creates sort of a crispy crust on it. Some of these historically are baked with an actual crust, like a shortbread crust. So this was our way to mimic that. It bakes for about 50 minutes or so.
And then you take it out, you let it cool, you stand around, you want to eat it, but you have to wait.
You should let it cool completely. It's a really good idea. It's a different texture, warm and cool.
So a Spanish almond cake, it's flourless, it's a one-bowl cake. Just bake it in a cake pan. It's a macaroon in the form of a cake. Thank you.
You're welcome. You can get this recipe for Spanish almond cake on 177milkstreet.com.
I'm Christopher Kimball. You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Coming up, more of your culinary questions and conundrums with my co-host, Sarah Bolton. We'll be right back. If you enjoy Milk Street Radio, please take a moment to review us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your other favorite podcast app. This helps other people find the show and encourages them to listen. Thanks. You know, I grew up with Vermont farmers who made do with tools they had on hand. A hammer, pliers, and baling twine, of course, for most jobs. When I became a cook, however, I found that having just the right knife or maybe the perfect carbon steel skillet made all the difference. And the right tool also added pleasure to my cooking. I truly enjoyed my time prepping as well as cooking food. And that also goes for a car. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. And that includes available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This is Milstead Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Right now, it's time to take a few more calls with my co-host, Sarah Moulton. Sarah, you ready for a new batch of questions?
Yes, Chris, I am very ready.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Karen Berry from Portland.
How can we help you?
I have been gathering teaspoons, tablespoons, you know, measuring sets for years. And now that I'm retired, I decided, well, I wonder which one is actually accurate. And they all disagree with each other. So I was hoping you might have a method that will let me know which ones I can get rid of and which ones I should keep.
Do you have a digital scale?
Yes.
Okay, then you're good to go. Just look up the weight of a tablespoon of fill in the blank, like table salt.
Brilliant.
And measure the various, use the different spoons for measuring and see how they weigh. But would you bring up a really good point? I felt the same thing. Even measuring cups, like the dry cups.
Oh, yeah, they're not the
same.
They're
totally different. They're off like 10 same. Or 15%.
But here's the other really big problem. I mean, it doesn't matter. You just decide what you're going to work with. But there's no international standard for what one cup of flour should weigh.
Huh.
Yeah, so the Europeans say one thing. King Arthur flour says 120 grams. Somebody else says something else. So whatever
well,
you do, you just...
depends on the flour, too.
Yes, it does.
So you have to decide who's going to be your barometer, whose measurements you're going to use. I use King Arthur flour just because I think they're very reliable. And they say one cup equals 120 grams. So 1/16th of a cup would be one tablespoon if we're going by weight.
So what standard do you use? I'm asking Chris now because
At Milk Street, we did a few issues ago. We actually weighed a whole bunch of flours. We looked at 15 different sources, tried to come up with an approximate, and then we weighed it 10 or 15 times ourselves. So we published that.
What do you say one cup of AP flour weighs?
It's 5 ounces. An ounce is 137 grams. Is that correct? Something like that?
So that's more than King Arthur flour. They
it's
say 120.
Ounces. Yeah, in pastry, cake flour is 4.2 or 3 ounces. Bread flour is 5.5 ounces, something like that. I don't remember the exact grams. We measure everything in grams now, so instead of using volume.
Yeah, and I do sourdough baking with rye bread mostly, so it matters.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
All baking, the flour should definitely be weighed. I thought that the volume measurement was fine, and then years ago we had 10 people measure a cup of flour. They were all different.
When we did this King Arthur flour, there's 20 of us in a class. That's how they started the class. Yeah. Everybody measure a cup of flour. We went up to the front of the room. It went range from like 4 ounces to 7.
Really?
What a difference that makes in a recipe.
Wow.
Depending on whether people packed it, leveled it,
scooped it.
Yeah,
when you level the top, if you compact the flour into the cup, yeah, you get a much higher weight.
Right.
So I should do the same thing with my larger measuring.
Yes.
Cup.
Yes. Well, thanks for calling. That was an easy one.
That was.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care. You're listening to Mill Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. If you have a cooking failure complaint or if you just want to try to stump us, give us a call at 855-426-9843. That's 855-426-9843. Or email us at questions@millstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, my name is Kathy Pentek.
Hi, Kathy. How can we help you?
Well, I frequently buy whole chickens because I like to cook them. You know, they're inexpensive. You get a few meals out of them. And I roast them or I make soup. And I normally take the giblets and throw them away, and I feel terrible. Is there something better I could do with them, especially with the liver?
Well, they're going to be two diametrically opposed answers to this question, so I'll let Sarah go first.
Well, Sarah? I treat the livers. The livers are in a class by themselves. The gizzards are good in stock. Chris never makes stock, but they really beef up the flavor or chicken up the flavor of chicken stock. So it's great to, you know, you could accumulate a whole bunch, and then if you happen to make a chicken stock, which you can make with the leftover bones from the chicken that you've been roasting, throw those guys in. The livers are wonderful. Accumulate them in the freezer. And then what we used to do, I worked at this restaurant in Boston, is we would saute them up, add a few shallots, garlic, thyme, in oil. They pop like crazy. So wear your armor, you know, or have a spatter guard. First, okay, we dipped them in flour. And then we would remove them from the pan, deglaze the pan with white wine, heavy cream, Dijon mustard. And then we put them back in and finish cooking, and they're delicious. I made for brunch.
Is this perhaps a French restaurant?
Oh, be quiet. That's why we're going to fight here. But I wanted to tell you about my Jewish mother-in-law. She'd roast a chicken, and she would save the gizzards in the freezer. And then she'd make something she called chicken fricassee. She'd take all those gizzards, not the liver. Liver she'd make chopped liver out of, because liver will make things bitter if you add it. It has to be on its own. She'd saute those guys up, and then she'd make some little meatballs and add those to it, and then add some chicken broth and simmer the whole thing and with some chicken wings. And it was just a yummy first course. Yeah, and a very economical was the idea. You could even, you know, make that into a meal, put it on top of rice or potatoes or something. Okay, Chris.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Now I have to ask the question, which, are you someone who feels guilty a lot?
Yes, I do.
Okay, see, I could tell.
We all throw out way too much food, so I applaud whatever's motivating you.
I do too, but you have to really ask yourself the question, will you accumulate?
Gizzards are yummy.
Well, I know, but the reality is, as you all know, 3 or 4 months later, you're going through your freezer, see these little bags of gizzards, and you throw them out.
No, I'm sure Kathy has a better plan.
I'm supportive, but on the other hand, there are easier solutions. But anyway, once it goes in the freezer, it doesn't come out.
Okay. All right. Well, we don't agree, Kathy, but I've given you lots of good ideas.
Yes.
That sounds wonderful. And that sounds like the liver sounds delicious.
Yeah. Look, I just say one thing. I mean, you do need quite a few livers, chicken livers, to make a meal.
Yeah. Well, she could supplement with a small package from the store.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
If you could see Sarah's face right now.
Or what I do for the husband sometimes when I'm roasting a chicken and there's that happy little package, I'll take out just the liver and I'll saute it with garlic and olive oil and thyme, like I said, a rosemary, and then I'll put it on a piece of
toast.
Exactly.
Okay, well, that's...
Maybe to glaze the pan with a little Madeira or something, just even white wine, and
that's
throw
a
in a little
idea.
Bit of butter, and yum, yum, there's an hors d'oeuvre.
There you go.
Okay.
Sarah's ending on a high note. That was good. Kathy, thanks for calling.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Okay,
greatly.
Kathy.
Sure. Take care.
Take care.
This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. It's time for this week's Milk Street Basic. Here at Milk Street, we're not a great fan of white sugar unless we want other flavors to come through. So here are some other sugars we have in our pantry. The first is palm sugar. This is cooked down from the sap of the coconut palm, and palm sugar tastes earthy and has a really creamy, rich mouthfeel. By the way, it needs to be crushed or dissolved to use. We use it in Thai-style dipping sauces with fish sauce, garlic, and lime juice. We use it in meat glazes. We slather this thickly across grilled or roasted meats just during the last few minutes of cooking. Or you can melt it in your morning oatmeal or use it to sweeten your coffee or tea, either hot or iced. The next kind of sugar is jaggery. This comes from India, and it's produced from either sugarcane or date palm sap. Both of these have a maple-like flavor that really tastes great. We don't recommend it for baked sweets, but we do like it when dissolved in a glaze for meats or stirred into rice pudding. The third kind is panela or piloncillo. It's a Mexican raw sugarcane. It's earthy, it's rich tasting, and you can substitute it for white or brown sugar. We like it in hot chocolate or coffee, tossed with berries, or we like to use it to temper the spiciness of chili or put into a pot of beans. And finally, muscovado sugar. It's a raw, moist cane sugar produced in Mauritius and also the Philippines. We use it in everything from our coffee to blondies, where its flavor comes through nice and clear. For more culinary tips and ideas, please visit us at 177milkstreet.com. Next up, I chat with Dr. Aaron Carroll. Dr. Aaron Carroll, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
So we're talking about regulations today, food, habits, soda, what?
I've been hearing from too many friends recently worrying about the mercury that they're eating in fish, especially when they may or may not be pregnant, and I thought we could talk about that for a bit.
Okay.
So clearly mercury is not good for you, and you know it's been eliminated from many of the products that we might ingest, but mercury is a problem, and it does exist in seawater, and while we don't drink much seawater because fish drink a lot of seawater, it's very possible that they are accumulating mercury, and many are, and there's some things that people should and should not know about what they're looking for with respect to fish.
So is this the tuna fish scare we're talking about here?
So tuna is a big one. So mercury, because it's found in water, and it's hard to get rid of, fish that live longer have higher levels of mercury. And of course, the bigger the fish, the bigger the problem. And when your big fish are eating little fish, they're also eating the mercury in those little fish. Therefore, large, long-lived fish like sharks and swordfish are the ones that are going to have the highest levels of mercury. And of course, we should be concerned about mercury because there's reasonable evidence that when people ingest too much of it, especially pregnant women, it can have effects in their children. But a lot of that is, again, as we've talked about with many other episodes, there's a statistically significant danger, but not necessarily a clinically significant danger. So for every extra sort of microgram that we might find measurable in a pregnant woman's hair, which is how you look for it, you see a decrease of about 0.7 points in his or her child's IQ. And that sounds a bit scary, but you got to realize that the vast majority of people would never see that. 90% of pregnant women in the United States have no more than 1.4 micrograms of mercury in their hair. And of course, a point or two of IQ is not even going to show up. And the median value of mercury in women is like 0.2. So it's really not there. But still, fish that have, you know, high levels of mercury theoretically should be avoided and you shouldn't eat them in huge amounts. But as always, this has to be weighed against the positives that might come from eating fish. So there's a lot of observational studies, which are the same kind of data, that show that eating fish that are high in omega-3 fatty acids actually could have significant benefits with respect to heart disease, with respect to even neurologic outcomes and positives in all kinds of respects. And so those need to be weighed against the negatives. Now, one of the things that people need to be concerned about is that a lot of the fish that tend to be high in omega-3 fatty acids also tend to be high in mercury, things like tuna. And so people that eat too much tuna theoretically could get concerned about how much mercury they're consuming. So the best bet would be foods that are high in omega-3 fatty acids and low in mercury, things like salmon, herring, and sardines. And you could clearly avoid fish that are low in omega-3 fatty acids and high in mercury. And those tend to be things like grouper, orange roughy, and canned tuna. But in general, when we look at all the research together, there's clearly much more evidence that a modest intake of fish consumption carries far more benefits with respect to a whole host of diseases than any of the fear that you're going to get from consuming too much mercury.
So when they do these studies about fish consumption, is it because someone's consuming more fish and less red meat, or is it strictly on the basis of the fish itself?
It's a great question. So some of it is clearly when we talk about things like cardiovascular disease and things like cancer, some potential benefit may be from how much fish they are eating versus red meat. However, they still try to do some studies, and the best studies would still control for that and actually look at how much fish people are consuming above and beyond, you know, replacing it with some other concerning things like red meat or especially processed red meat.
So here's the real question, which is, can I have one tuna fish sandwich a week?
I think easily that would be no trouble at all. I mean, you know, again, you have to eat pretty large quantities of this stuff in order to really get into danger. And people that are talking about things like once a week, I would consider that moderation in almost any book.
So I could have one cup of coffee, one drink of scotch, and one tuna fish sandwich a week.
You could have much, much more coffee and even much more scotch as well.
More wine, more coffee, more scotch, less tuna fish. Dr. Aaron Carroll, thank you so much.
Anytime.
Dr. Aaron Carroll is professor of pediatrics at Indiana University School of Medicine, also a regular contributor to the New York Times Upshot column. You know, early in the show, I spoke with Maura Judkis about pumpkin pie spice. She mentioned that Starbucks pumpkin spice latte might be available as early as August. Of course, that made me wonder if holiday promotions can actually start too early. A poll by CNBC found that many young adults liked holidays starting early. Christmas now starts before Halloween. At this rate, the day after Christmas will be the kickoff for next year's Christmas. That's it for this week's show. If you tuned in too late, you can find Milk Street Radio on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, or Spotify. Remember to please subscribe to the show. You'll automatically get every episode downloaded to your phone or tablet each week. If you want to learn more about Milk Street, head to 177milkstreet.com. There you can download each week's recipe, subscribe to our magazine, watch our television show, or order our new cookbook that was just published in September. We'll be back next week, and thanks for listening.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with WGBH. Executive producer, Melissa Baldino. Senior audio editor, Melissa Allison. Producer, Annie Sinzabaugh. Associate producer, Jackie Nowak, and production help from Debbie Paddock. Senior audio engineer, Douglas Sugarts. Additional editing from Vicki Merrick and Sydney Lewis, and audio mixing from Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Theme music by Two Bob Crew. Additional music by George Brendel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.